Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. In the American West, there's often conflict between agriculture and wildlife. Bears, wolves, elk. So imagine what it's like for an African farmer when a herd of elephants decides to raid your crops. Neither the problems nor the solutions are simple. But Dr. Jonah Western has spent a lifetime working on it, and what he's learned just may be useful to us. Jonah, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground. What led to your interest in conservation?
I grew up in what was then Tanganyika. My father was a hunter. He had been via India for 8 years and got very interested in tigers and elephants. So when he came out to actually Kenya during the war, he got very intrigued in African wildlife. It was far better than anything he had seen in India. So I literally grew up on the elephant trail.
In Africa?
In Africa, in Tanzania.
And what period are we talking about?
We're talking about the late 1940s through the 1950s. And the last of the great hunters in Africa had actually retired to southern Tanzania because that was the last of the great places for elephants. But at the same time, they were very concerned about elephants disappearing from the ivory trade, from poaching of one sort or another. So my father got very involved in conservation as a sort of natural transfer from elephant hunting to protecting elephants.
That's his story. What led to your response in terms of interest in conservation? Sometimes young boys go in opposite directions of their dads, I hear.
Not so much an opposite direction, I would say beyond.
All right.
His main interest was setting aside national parks, which he felt would be sacrosanct and would protect the elephants. Whereas growing up, I heard people outside the national park saying, we've been removed from our traditional areas. Why should we protect government animals?
Now, you heard this at what age?
Early teens, 13, 14.
Okay.
And these were people who were our trackers, the local communities we met. And my father was very involved also in human-wildlife conflict because a lot of the problem at that time was elephant numbers were actually building up. And so he was left to deal with the problem of how to reduce the conflict with local people. So their response is, why should we give up our land inside and then have the elephants come outside and destroy our crops?
When you say he was left with a conflict, did he have a government position?
He was an honorary warden with the game department at that time.
I see.
And so his problem was both to conserve elephants, and the contradictory side was protect people from elephants.
All right, so here you are, a teenager, seeing this, growing up, if I'm understanding you, among local African people and hearing this profound complaint.
That's correct.
First, why did what they have to say matter to you as a boy or a young man?
Well, I think, again, partly because my father was very interested in local peoples. In India, he had become fluent in Hindustani and Gujarati. He was interpreter for his regiment in the army. And when he came to Kenya and Tanzania, he became very fluent in Kiswahili very quickly. So literally, it was seeing local peoples as traditional occupants of the land. He was very interested in that. And I think he had a genuine compassion for local people, which I certainly picked up at a very young age.
You say you picked it up. Why? In other words, that you could have walked away. You could have become interested in diamond mines or space travel. Why did this affect you? Do you remember any particular incident that comes to mind that you said, this matters to me?
There were two incidents which really turned my mind and the way I thought about wildlife. First of all, my father, together with the trackers he had, really trained me to the ultimate degree in tracking and stalking animals and so on before I was allowed to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I shot my first animal, the thrill of the tracking was already over, and I was really moved by that dead animal, and I felt that I had done something by taking away a life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was what I called a stillborn hunter. I never wanted to hunt again after that. But at the same time, almost on the same safari, we ended up in a village called Magambo, where the entire village had been evacuated by people who had been attacked by elephants. Hmm. And a local person who we knew there, he was a former tracker, had been killed by the elephant literally crushing his hut. So that really led me to the realization that the problem with elephants is, on the one hand, they're big, they need a lot of space. On the other, give them a field of corn, and they're going to prefer that to thorn, and then you've got a problem with people. So I was really concerned to end the killing as I saw it, and to try and find peace, a very naive idea at the time, between people and elephants.
Naive or not, we'll discuss that idea, but clearly complicated, not simple. Where did it lead you in terms of your career? You've had a unique career in conservation. So what are the steps after this realization?
The realization was that national parks were going to be really the future of tourist industries in Kenya and Tanzania. So my father really switched from hunting to becoming more or less a tour operator and promoting tourism. And I began to see that side as an important way of resolving the conflict and really providing money to justify wildlife in East Africa. And that became the mantra of the national governments as they approached independence. They saw tourism as a big new industry. So what convinced me to really take a different track were two things. First of all, my father was killed by an elephant when he was out on elephant protection, protecting local people. Huh. And so my entire future seemed to be scrapped in one single move.
How old were you when you died?
I was then 14. And so I realized this conflict, to me, had a really personal side to it. I had to resolve that conflict. I loved elephants, but having my father killed by an elephant really gave me the feel that local people really met on an everyday basis. So I then went to England shortly afterwards. My mother went back to England, and I decided to take a degree in zoology. Why? Because the other side of what I realized in national parks is that we really knew very little about wildlife at that time. And most of the national parks were dry season concentrations for elephants, wildebeest, zebra. During the rains, you never saw them inside a national park. So I was impressed that we didn't know where those animals migrated. And we had to know a lot more about animals in order to understand the ecology, the behavior, if we're going to conserve them.
This is the 50s and 60s?
This is the 1960s.
60s, okay.
At the beginnings of what you would call the environmental movement. So in Britain, I took a degree in zoology, focusing on ecology. And then I looked around for a graduate program which would do what we now call biology of conservation. And there wasn't any at all, with one exception, the University of Nairobi in Kenya. It was the first of what we call the biology of conservation courses. This is in the 1960s. So I then enrolled for a graduate degree, a PhD at the University of Nairobi. And I looked around specifically for a site that had lots of wildlife, that was not yet a national park, had lots of conflict, and where I could begin to understand the traditional relationship of people and wildlife, why there was coexistence in the past, and why that was breaking down today. So Amboseli really became my mecca in terms of understanding how this all worked.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dr. Jonah Western about conservation in Africa and elsewhere. I think I just heard you say in the past there had been coexistence and now there was conflict, and why? What did you learn about that? That's a profound transition. What was its cause?
It was a contradiction to me by the time I got back to East Africa. On the one hand, the colonial and now the independent governments were rushing ahead creating more and more national parks because they felt there was no future for wildlife with local people. They would simply destroy them. And yet, at the same time, having grown up in Tanzania, I was extremely impressed that wherever you went, there were people and wildlife together. So to me, the bigger question, now having a degree in zoology and understanding the ecology better, was why, when clearly there was coexistence, when the most important areas the governments were trying to set aside, Serengeti, Amboseli, Masai Mara, Samburu, all these were areas of remarkable wildlife density. But at the same time, they were the richest livestock areas in the pastoral region. So how is it that you've had this past coexistence, and yet today we have to create two separate spaces for them in order to find a place for wildlife? And so the study I began in Amboseli was a completely open chapter. How did this coexistence work in the past? How did the Maasai live with wildlife? What did they feel about them? And how do they feel about their area being taken over as a national park and then dispossessed from that area?
one might suspect they don't feel great about it.
Well, the second part of the question was clear all across Kenya by that time, and in fact, East Africa. National parks were called Shambala Bibi, which in Kiswahili before independence meant the farm owned by the Queen of England. And so it was pretty clear that when you take away that land, you dispossess them not only of the wildlife, which they had used in the past, but also their land. So I tried to find a new solution which said, let's go back to the basics. Where do animals move and why do they move? And how do the pastoralists with their livestock fit into this picture? And what became obvious within about a year, based on counts on the ground and then working with the Maasai, is that they had a remarkably similar migration. They moved to the same place with the rains. They moved back to dry season concentration areas at the end of the very dry periods. And so this coexistence was really an interlinked ecology.
Now, let me just get something straight. The Maasai have livestock. They're cattle people, correct?
The Maasai are cattle people who live entirely off their livestock. They
okay.
don't have any farms.
So they move, and you're saying that they had similar migration routes, the livestock and the big animals, the elephants, for example.
They had very similar migrations to the zebra, wildebeest, and other species, and they
okay.
all moved to the same place.
So why was there not conflict historically if they were moving in the same areas? Because there would be theoretically conflict for forage.
Well, the first part of the question I got very quickly, it's mobility. So long as you're all moving around, there's sufficient space for wildlife to fit in the gaps where the livestock are not at that time. Likewise, the Maasai had to move extremely fast to keep up with the wildlife migrations. Otherwise, they lost out on the foraging. But the real trick, and my understanding, came from a Maasai saying to me, you have to understand cattle to understand Amboseli. You have to see it through the eyes of a cow. So he literally gave me two cattle, Sotwa and Matingab, and I had to herd cattle to understand what Amboseli meant to him.
And you're how old when you're herding
the
cattle?
I was then 24, 25.
Okay.
And what I began to see very quickly is that they had an incredible barometer of how well they're doing through the udder of their cows. How much milk came out of that udder was an indication of how well they were doing foraging. And that led them to exactly the same migration movements as wildlife. But why protect wildlife in a sense? That came in the big droughts of the 1970s when their own livestock were dying out. And they said literally in the past, when we had no cattle left or very few, we turned to cattle, what we called our second cattle, wildlife, during droughts in order to recover our herds after the droughts. So they called them their second cattle.
You say they lived off wildlife?
Wildlife. They lived off wildlife.
Wildlife during the droughts.
During the droughts until such time as they recovered their own herds after the droughts.
What's jumping out at me as a resident of the state of Montana are parallels between agriculturally based people, different circumstances, for example, fences, typical, but both synergy and conflict potentially with between livestock and large mammals. We'll get back to that. Now, you've come to this realization. What do you do about it in summary form? How do you influence this realization that you've come to?
The trick was reestablishing the role that wildlife played as their second cattle, but not by eating them during the dry seasons, but using the new tourism economy, which was beginning to boom in Kenya, and convincing government through policy that local people should be involved in the benefits of national parks and wildlife on their land so that we encouraged ecotourism outside parks. So by the late 1970s, the government had been convinced to do that, had got a loan from the World Bank, and Amboseli became the first of the community-based supported national parks.
Now, when you say ecotourism outside the parks, the inference is that that has some economic benefits to local peoples that are tangible to them?
That's correct. So two forms of benefit. First of all, looking at the national park, how much time do wildlife spend outside on their ranches? And then that cost would be covered by income from the national park, a payment for ecological services, as we call it today. Then the second was recognizing that wildlife spent much of the year outside on their land, so why not set up tourism what we now call ecotourism, mm-hmm. on their land as well. So they see a direct benefit through tourism on their land.
When you say they see a direct benefit, they're hired as guides, they serve food. What's the direct benefit?
They set aside ecotourist lodges with the support of the tourist industry. They train up local guides. They have a lot of employment in the tourist industry and guards and so forth.
So that's an interesting theory. This is, you said, they were now in the 70s. You end up in a responsible government position at some point.
I was made the director of parks planning at that stage to introduce that as a national policy. So Amboseli became the first test case. And by the 1980s, revenue was going back to the local community. They were beginning to set up tourism outside the national parks on their own land.
Just parenthetically, this is post-independence, right? There's been this huge upheaval from the time you started living in Africa. You had a colonial structure. Now you have independence. So there's massive political upheaval. Is that fair? And from a colony to an independent nation. How do Africans look at a white man, even though you grew up there, in a position of authority? Was that a problem?
No, because I think my role in introducing community-based conservation and reducing those conflicts, and in fact something the government saw very clearly, increasing the scope for tourism on a much larger scale than the overcrowded national parks, and at the same time benefiting local communities, was a win-win situation.
Okay, so now you're in this influential position. You're the head of planning. What happens over the next, say, 10 years in the 1980s?
Well, over the 1980s, Amboseli became really the best-known case. Elephants were under severe pressure by that time. They were being poached almost to extinction in many areas, including Kenya. For ivory, the international ivory trade. Everywhere throughout Kenya, elephants were in decline from 160,000 down to about 19,000 by the time of the ivory ban in the 1980s.
160,000 to 19,000.
With the exception of Amboseli, because the local Maasai were now involved, they said, these are our elephants, we will protect them. And so the elephant population in Amboseli slumped to a very low level, then turned around and increased and became the best studied elephant population in Africa through the work of Cynthia Moss and many others. And that's what really grabbed Liz and Art's attention when they first came to East Africa.
Now, this is Liz Claiborne, Art Ordenberg, who will be known to our listeners as longtime Montana residents, who funded what I'll call people-oriented conservation programs over a long period of time in Montana. So they came into your world when?
They came into my world in 1988. They were absolutely delightful. They came really on a trip to get a sense, which I began to understand very quickly, of what are the key issues in wildlife and how can we, having just set up a foundation, really make a difference? And I think what they saw very clearly and what I saw in them is they had a passion for wild animals, particularly elephants and tigers and other animals like that. But they were looking for a solution that also recognized that people were an important part of the issue. And so the turnaround in Amboseli, I think, really caught their attention. So one of the first projects they funded was monies to Amboseli to help make this new arrangement work.
What does that mean, monies to help make it work? For what purpose were the monies used?
They were providing water to a pipeline scheme which took water outside Amboseli, which is the only area it was available to the Maasai, and distributed it more widely so they had access to water outside the national park.
That then it reduces impacts of animals seeking water in concentrated areas, but disperses access improves the environmental impact.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's how they get involved. And you've been involved with the foundation since then, 1980s.
Yeah, Liz and Art, at the end of that, asked if I would help them establish the foundation. So that was 1989, and so I became the first member of their advisory board at that stage. And we worked for the best part of a year on the vision for the foundation and combining two things which were really very clear in Liz and Art. Liz had this deep passion for wildlife. Art was the thinker. He thought strategically. How can we put these two things together and have a very clear direction for the foundation which fills this gap between straight protectionism and the involvement of local people? And that's what attracted them about Amboseli.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dr. Jonah Western about conservation in Africa and Montana and about the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation. Now, somewhere along this line, I apologize for forgetting the chronology, you end up as like the director of conservation for the nation of Kenya.
That's correct.
When is that?
I was appointed by the president of Kenya, Daniel Arap Moi, as director of the Kenya Wildlife Service in 1994. And the reason is that Kenya had made a huge commitment to protecting elephants and other creatures after the ivory ban came in 1989. But what he was looking for after the first director, Richard Leakey, resigned, was a way still of involving local people in the benefits of wildlife and tourism. And that's why he appointed me as director of Kenya Wildlife Service.
Let's talk in the time we have left about the vision. It's a simple concept, but it seems to me implementing it is immensely complex. Ivory is worth a lot of money, so there are major financial incentives for people to kill elephants for ivory. To try to counterbalance that with income from, let's say, ecotourism so people can see elephants, somebody on the ground might say, I can make a hell of a lot more money by killing that elephant than I can by serving food for a tourist. How's it worked in practice over time?
The way it worked at that point is that one of the first species programs that Liz and Art took on was addressing what was driving the ivory trade and this incredible demand for ivory here in America, Europe, and the Far East. And so they commissioned the Ivory Trade Review Group to look in all aspects of the trade and realized that unless they got the demand for ivory down, based on good hard evidence of the impending extinction of the elephants, there would be no ivory trade. That study had an enormous impact in bringing together all the main players and tabling the evidence that led to the ivory ban in 1989 through the International Trade Network CITES.
Has it worked? In other words, I keep reading as an outsider of people with basically paramilitary units of poachers out there.
It did work. It worked for a long period of time, and the elephant populations began to build up all across Africa until a new market developed in the late 2008-2009. Really, the new markets in Asia, China and elsewhere. And so these have created, if you like, an illegal demand for ivory. And the price has now gone up to about $2,000 a kilo.
In this case, one might argue you have a global marketplace, even though it's illegal, placing an incredible premium on a product that, if not contained or controlled, will destroy this species.
It will not only destroy the species, but it will destroy the livelihoods of those communities who are protecting the elephants, because they get nothing out of poaching, but they get a great deal out of the tourism industry.
So how is that playing out?
It's playing out in an important way. Just to go back to Liz and Art one moment, the next thing they did, which was very important, was support the global movement of community-based conservation, holding a meeting, first of all, in Airlie House here in Virginia, and then in the Interior West, particularly concerning Montana and other states.
At Red Lodge in 2001.
That's correct. So can we involve landowners, whether they're ranchers, whoever they are, in seeing more out of conservation? And so that led to the movement of community-based conservation. Now, the evidence is very clear. Wherever you have these strong communities in Eastern Africa, there's very little elephant poaching. Extremely little elephant poaching. Why? Because they see them as their elephants. They are the informers to the Kenya Wildlife Service, these crack operations of anti-poaching forces who then come in and take out the poachers. So the combination of local benefits and protecting these endangered species has become extremely important, combining endangered species protection with the benefits locally. That's a very strong combination.
Obviously, there are successes and defeats in any strategic venture that challenges the status quo. What are the implications for the future from a cold-eyed perspective? Is it a viable strategy? Is it partially viable? What would you say are the key lessons over this extended period of time?
I think the key lessons of involving local communities is that you're winning, if you like, the hearts and minds of people to be more pro-conservation. But it doesn't stop there. They need a great deal of support for their programs. They need to build the capacity to manage conflict when it arises, to manage tourism, and so on. So if you like, opening the door to community-based conservation is just the beginning of a long, long road to building the capacity and the involvement of communities. And that's what the foundation, through Liz and Art, have done superbly well. They've done that in Montana, Arizona, Mexico with the Malpai Borderlands Group and so on. So they've, I think, played a seminal role in not only introducing the movement of community-based conservation, but also showing the downsides, the upsides, and sticking with it long enough to show what really does work and what doesn't.
Let's look at Montana for a second. I've worked there in conservation for 25 years, pursuing that vision. My sense is you have very strong grassroots conservation organizations that comprise X percentage of the population, have some public policy influence. But what has not yet happened is, let's say, in the livestock way of life or timber-dependent communities, a transition where people say, we're not just logging. Let's say we're engaged in restorative forestry that will benefit wildlife and our children will have a better life because of it. In other words, a shift from a strict utilitarian mindset to see wildlife as important to their future. Does anything in your African experience suggest a way forward there?
I think there is a parallel. I don't believe that the rancher really is going to make sufficient money out of wildlife alone, or if you like, biodiversity, to make it pay and therefore give up what he or she is already doing. But in the case of Kenya, we've combined three things together. The NGO does conservation work in local community areas and brings in support for conservation. The tourist industry brings in important additional revenues over and above the ranch income. Mm-hmm. And then the rancher benefits from both those parties being there. So it's a hybrid approach rather than the rancher or the forester going it alone and having to do it all.
You've been involved with Liz and Art personally and with the foundation for more than a quarter century. You've had a long and distinguished conservation career. As you look forward, optimist, pessimist, mixed, and why?
I tend towards the optimistic side because in my life, when I grew up, there was no future for wildlife. The national parks were not yet in place, and local people saw them as the enemy. Over the last 50 years, I've seen a big change, where there's more sentiment, more concern for wildlife. There's more interest in the benefits from wildlife, which didn't exist then. The big challenge for me is how you put those elements together, and I don't think we're there yet. I think we've got to explore lots of new solutions, whether it's conservation easements, whether it's payment for ecological services. I think the new techniques, the new approaches are only just beginning. So the big issue for the future is how we put together the interests of those who live with wildlife on a day-to-day basis and the larger emerging issues, particularly in urban areas, which are clearly pro-conservation. But we've got this deep divide between those beneficiaries in the cities and at a global level and the real costs on the ground who are borne by landowners. That's the divide we have to bridge.
Dr. Jonah Western, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.